My name is Cal. I'm one of the pastors here at Bow Valley Christian Church. You ever feel like sometimes you just need a good cry? If you ask my family, crying is not my forte. It's not something I do regularly. Barely. But I think all of us who cry often or rarely cry, sometimes we have to admit, sometimes we just need a good cry. There's something about crying that takes this emotional energy that we have inside of us and makes it tangible. It somehow gives reality to what we're feeling inside that almost seems hidden. It can be cathartic, both physically and mentally and certainly emotionally. Broken relationships deserve a good cry. It isn't unusual for people to cry when they visit the Museum of Broken Relationships and read the stories. Not just because the stories are sad, which a lot of them are, but they touch sore spots in the visitor's life in a relatability sort of way. And as the visitors read the stories, it gives them permission to cry in solidarity with those stories. The Museum of Broken Relationships started in Croatia between two ex-lovers who are trying to figure out what to do with these mementos of their relationship that has now been asundered. And so they've been gathering objects that people send to them for the last 17 years. They have over 4,000 items the last time that someone had checked. And it now actually travels around the world. If you visit one of these museums of broken relationships, you might see a pair of rubber gloves, a set of acupuncture pens, a stack of adult magazines, a prosthetic leg, a book titled, I Can Make You Thin, a garden gnome, a bicycle. Just looking at these objects, you start to wonder, what's the story behind that? So anytime that someone sends an object, they send a short story to describe their story for people to read. And the website, it says, it is a museum about you, about us, about the ways we love and our loss. Interesting thinking about the Museum of Broken Relationships, because we're in a series about three key things. We've got a sign here that says faith, hope, and love. And right now we've been focusing on different anchors of our hope. Something to think about in the midst of our broken relationships. And it seems like the more that we love someone, the more that broken relationship hurts, doesn't it? And I think all of us at some point in our lives, probably even right now, are thinking of certain relationships that are broken, that we wish were not that way, that it's a sore spot. Some of us are even uncomfortable even thinking about it because the pain is so real, and we've probably shed many tears over those. Sometimes those broken relationships can be a result of distance, distrust, disgust, divorce, or even death. Years ago, I spent a year researching on how to heal broken relationships. And I wrote a thesis on it, and I poured my time into trying to understand what are the best ways to help mend broken relationships. I focused mainly on in the church context. And then I helped heal two churches that had split and celebrated reconciliation that was a result of that. And then I found myself, I moved, my wife and I, we moved to Lethbridge. And I had this one relationship. It was a client of mine. And it was my third job. So I had a full-time job, I had a part-time job, and then I had this gentleman as my client. And he paid me well, which was quite appreciative, very helpful at the time, because I had a newborn. And it was a struggle to make ends meet. And so any extra spare time that I could offer, I was pouring my time into doing some design work for this gentleman. And one night he called me, and it was a hard day. It was a long day. I'd come home from my day job. The best thing for me coming home was just holding my brand new little baby girl and to give some respite to my wife, who is still in the midst of studies. And then the phone rings. And this gentleman is on the phone, my client, and he's like, "I need you to work on a project right now." And I said, I'm sorry, I can't. I just got home. And I got to spend some time with my daughter. And I got to be here for my wife. I can't just drop everything and run. No, I need you to work on this project right now. Gary, I'm sorry, it's not going to happen tonight. I didn't think much of it after that. I thought I had reasonable excuses not to drop everything and to take care of whatever he needed me to take care of. Well, the next day he showed up at my place of business, or the place that I had my day job. And I thought, well, maybe here's a chance we can negotiate a different time for me to work, continue on this particular project. And he wouldn't talk to me. In fact, he talked to my coworker. He's standing right there. I'm standing right here. He said to my coworker, "You tell Cal I'm not talking to him. Tell Cal that I don't ever want to talk to him again." I just spent a year studying about how to heal and reconcile broken relationships, had some success in doing it, and now I was at a loss of what to do with this fellow. And so I was trying different techniques and different things and trying to patch things up. Nothing. I just got the cold batch treatment. And it hurt. It hurt, even though it was a working relationship. It wasn't, we weren't close friends and that sort of thing. It still hurt. And I think that there's a part of us in those times, in those situations where we feel like, I hope that's not the end of the story. I hope that that cold shoulder or that back turned to us is not the end of the story. That we want more than just that. Our soul cries out for some sort of happy ending. So where's our hope? Well, the ache is real that we want this happy ending and it's not there right now. And I think there's something important just to understand in that very fact, that the reason that we have the ache, I believe, is because we are made in the image of God, and relationships matter to God. And so when there is a broken relationship, God's heart hurts. And since we are in His image, that is why our hearts hurt. And maybe there's good reasons for broken relationships. Maybe there's not. But it still hurts. We were made, I believe, to want restoration in those relationships. We crave restoration. So where can we find hope in a broken relationship? Well, I suggest to you two places today. In church, and in the bathroom. Just work with me for a second here. In the church, this is Jesus' suggestion. And we'll see that in a second here. The second one, the bathroom, is a bit of an analogy. Well, let's start in the church. In all fairness, Jesus' story really takes place in a temple. church is not a temple. We are the temple. But I think in a church context, there's some application or parallels. So this is what Jesus says as he's speaking to a large audience. So if you're presenting a sacrifice at the altar in a temple, and you suddenly remember that someone has something against you, leave your sacrifice there at the altar. Go and reconcile to that, be reconciled to that person. Then come and offer your sacrifice to God. Now, Jesus is speaking to a Jewish audience who very much understands sacrifice and presenting the sacrifice at an altar in the temple of God. The book of Leviticus describes the sacrificial system well that was established for years for the nation of Israel under the law of Moses. Israelites were to bring their sacrifices to atone for sin and guilt, or as a thank offering or a peace offering to God. These Israelites were most assuredly commanded to bring these sacrifices and have them properly offered by a priest or the Levites. In fact, failure to do so would be understood as disobedience. And you can just imagine that it's not like they just drove up to their local temple, grabbed out a lamb, had it sacrificed on the altar. Years ago, it would have been a journey for them. There would have been not just the sacrifice of the offering, but to get to the temple, traveling on foot for many miles, pushing through clouds of dust on aching feet, kind of like what some of you are going to feel like when you're in the Holy Land in a few weeks. Sometimes they might have to linger in the countryside for respite in the sun-searing heat. And the path to the temple may have, there may be hidden dangers along the way, predators that may have been stalking them and waiting for them. But despite all these hardships and the risks, these faithful came. Anticipation began to stir as they would see the temple rise up on the horizon line. And they got excited as they were able to offer their gift to God, this peace offering, to restore this relationship that they desperately craved. Once in view, the city appeared as a jewel, the white stones glistening in the sun. Reconciliation motivated them to pick up their pace. But Jesus says, before you do that, seek restoration with your brother or sister. Before you sacrifice to God, sacrifice yourself to your brother and sister. Offer yourself as a gift of restoration, as a peace offering. Now, if we're honest, when someone sins against us, don't we find countless ways to compound their error and the sin, that we start to assume the worst and we read even more evil into their misled action? Well, you know, they did this, but this is what they meant. And this is really what they were getting at. And probably tomorrow they're going to even say this or do that. And so we sulk quietly, nurturing bitterness and resentment. And sometimes as we have this inner turmoil, we start to even lash out to the people around us. Maybe we start to play martyr. And start to forget that we're imperfect sinners that have hurt other people too. So we share our hurt, our pain, with our friends. Sometimes the Bible uses a word that describes that. It's called gossip. We claim the high moral ground and say, they did the wrong thing. Let them make the first move and sort it out. Anyone relate to that one? But notice again where Jesus lays the responsibility. We often think that it is the person who has wronged us that needs to make the first move. And I don't think Jesus disagrees with that. That's what he's saying here. That we who have wronged someone need to make the first move. But he knows that people are stubborn and relationships are too valuable and life is too short. And so he actually adds another example Whereas he says later on, he says, if you know that someone, so if we have wronged someone, we need to do something. If someone has wronged us, we need to do something. Because Jesus understands that in the game of figuring out who did what and how bad it was, we always feel it's someone else that's done the worst thing, and it's their job to come to us. And Jesus wants to just level the playing field and just say, no, don't wait, go. If they've hurt you, go. If you've hurt them, go. Jesus says, no matter where your broken relationships lie, no matter how you've arrived at that point, step up. Take the initiative, seek reconciliation. But there's no magic formula, and relationships are difficult. But to each person, Jesus says, do whatever's in your power to mend that which is broken. And so he says, it starts with you. Jesus knows what he's talking about. He didn't speak about this issue in an abstract sort of way or from a distance. He lived it out. Far more than anyone else in human history, Jesus embodies this dynamic of going, of resolving, of amending, of peacemaking. Jesus left the very throne room of God to come to us who have wronged him. He took on the humility of being born in a manger at Christmas and suffered a cruel fate on an Easter cross, also that we could be reconciled to him. So instead of sitting back, Jesus made the first move, and he calls us to do the same. His words call us back to the gospel, this offer of grace. And it's the hope for our relational challenges. So Matthew 5 is all about when someone has wronged you. Or sorry, when you have wronged someone. Matthew 18, verse 15, is when someone has wronged you. In both cases, we are compelled to go. Well, how do we go? A few short suggestions. I think the first thing is we go with confession to the other person. We go to that other person and we confess our part in the breakdown of the relationship. And sometimes that's very obvious, and sometimes we're going in, we're thinking, yeah, but it's really you. It's really your fault. But I think when we go with confession, we actually take some time to think, how are we complicit in this breakdown? How did we not hear maybe the heart of someone? And I think back to my relationship with Gary, and I've thought about it over and over again over the last 20-some years. I didn't hear his heart. Yes, he was demanding. And it was unreasonable, and I made the right decision, but I didn't communicate that well enough. I didn't communicate it in a way that showed some compassion, some understanding of what the turmoil was going on in his heart. And so maybe in some way, that's where I could have started. We have to go with confession to the other person. Beyond in a relationship, I think there's two phrases in a relationship that are the most powerful that we can ever utter someone, speak to someone else. One is, I love you. That is hugely powerful. And that's something that doesn't ever get old or stale. We love hearing that. And people love us when we say that. I love you. I love you. I love you. The second most powerful phrase we can utter is, I'm sorry. In fact, I think sometimes no one hears anything if they're mad at us or there's tension in the relationship until we say, I'm sorry. We can come up with excuses. We can say all kinds of stuff. We can do all kinds of stuff. But until we say, I'm sorry, they can't hear us. So we go with confession. That's the first thing. The second thing is we go with forgiveness to the other person. It's interesting, the dynamic of forgiveness. Forgiveness is as much for them as it is for us. That when we forgive someone, two things happen in our own hearts. The first thing is that often when an infraction has happened, we replay that event over and over and over in our minds. Especially when we've been hurt and when we've been wronged, we play it over and over. We relive that event over and over. And essentially, we're re-traumatizing ourselves over and over again. And when we forgive someone, essentially, we're saying, stop. We're stopping that recording from being repeated in our own minds. And that's a benefit for our own mental health. The second thing is that it sets us free. When we harbor unforgiveness, it's like we're weighted down. And weighted down, and weighted down. And when we forgive someone, it's like we are able to stand up again. And I think the same thing happens in other people's lives. When we offer forgiveness to them, they might be replaying a tape of guilt or anger, and that forgiveness says stop to that. And it lifts them up. There's a story told in the Old Testament between two prominent characters. Some of you may have heard of them, Jacob and Esau. Jacob was a trickster, devious. We could argue either legitimately or illegitimately, swindled his brother's birthright and inheritance and all these extra blessings. But Jacob took off for a while, and he had this broken relationship with his brother, and he was afraid. He was afraid that he was going to, at some point, his brother was going to have revenge upon him. So it's interesting in the story, not in my notes, but it just came to mind, it's so prominent. He is afraid for his life, and when Esau finally forgives him, that's when Jacob feels safe. When we offer forgiveness, we actually create places of safety for that other person, because they're afraid of retribution. That's what the world usually enacts. That's what we expect, but we create places of safety. Peacemakers are people who breathe grace. They draw continually on the goodness and the power of Jesus. And they bring his love and his mercy, forgiveness and strength and wisdom into the conflicts of daily life. And God delights to breathe life through peacemakers. And he uses them to dissipate anger, improve understanding, and promote justice and encourage repentance and restoration. It's a quote from Ken Sandy in his book, Peacemakers. It's interesting, though, I think, as we were thinking about that, so the first step is to go with confession. The second step is to go with forgiveness. The third step is go as far as you can. Paul, who wrote most of the New Testament, writes to the Christians in Rome in the letter titled Romans chapter 12, verse 18, he says, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Sometimes we offer forgiveness, sometimes we try to reconcile, but they don't want any of that. And so Paul is saying, do it as much as you can, go as far as you can go, but accept that it's a two-way street. The way I think of it, it takes two to tango, but one to lead. And Paul is asking us to be leaders. But we can't dance with someone unless they're willing to join us. Our supreme act of worship is connected to our relationships. And if we have a string of broken relationships that we haven't dealt with, we will limp along in our worship to God. So before you offer your gift to the Father that you've maybe sacrificed long and hard for, hold off. Don't delay. Go and try to reconcile a relationship with brother or sister, a neighbor, a friend, even an enemy. The second one. Before I say this, before I talk more about the bathroom, let me read from Ephesians 5, verse 13. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible. So reconciliation starts in the church, that is the altar, but it starts in the bathroom. Often and ironically, the place that we call the vanity. What's the vanity? It's that big mirror that we look at in the mornings. It's interesting. A few times I've tried to shave and I don't turn on the lights in the bathroom. It's a little dark. And so I'm shaving and then I get to work and I'm like, man, I missed a bunch of whiskers. How important light is. My family and daughters are thinking I'm still shaving in the dark. A few more whiskers than I need, I think. But when the lights come on, when we look in the mirror, what do we see? Well, I see all my imperfections. I see the different bad skin complexion, maybe a few whiskers here and there. My character lines, I like to call them. The light in the bathroom at the vanity highlights my imperfections. And sometimes it's hard to look at. Often it's hard to look at. And I want to find something, maybe foundation more gel or something on my face just to cover up those imperfections, but they're still there. This mirror is rather interesting because this one really highlights the imperfections. It's got like some sort of magnifying power, and so you could really get up close and see everything that you really don't want to see. But I think that's the place where reconciliation can start. Why is that? Because I think it's a great picture of the Christian life. Because as we see our imperfections, we realize we're not that perfect. We're not that good. We're not that righteous. We don't have it that together. And hopefully that would lead us not to a point of despair, but a point of humility and say, I need God to help me in this. That I am often just as complicit of doing wrongdoing as this person that I have something against or that has something against me. When we see our imperfections, hopefully it leads us to humility. But there's another interesting thing about being in the bathroom. That the closer we get to the light, the brighter the light sometimes, our imperfections actually start to disappear. And I think that's where the true analogy starts to come to fruition. That yes, we see our imperfections, but as we get closer and closer to the light, the light starts to shine out those imperfections that they become blinded. Our eyes are blinded to that. And essentially that's what Jesus does to us, that when we come to the light of God, that his light, his glory, his grace, his mercy starts to hide our imperfections, starts to blind to our sight the imperfections that we have. And we just see him and his glory. And that gives us hope. When we stand in the light of Jesus, his righteousness blinds out our imperfections. So let's look at the last part of the verse. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible, and everything that is illuminated becomes light. When you stand close to Jesus, you start to shine Jesus outward. Shining Jesus is shining his grace and his mercy, shining his hope that there is restoration and reconciliation. That is why this is good news. So two things. It starts at in the church where we hold off on our gift and go. The second thing is it starts in the bathroom where we see our imperfections, develop humility, and then we step closer to the light and become reflections of God's grace. And in that, we can heal relationships. It's a good time to go. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul says this. He says, all this is a gift from God, who brought us back to himself through Christ. And God has given us the task of reconciliation, reconciling people to him. For God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, no longer counting people's sins against them. And he gave us this wonderful message of reconciliation too. So we are essentially Christ's ambassadors, Paul says. God is making his appeal through us. We speak for Christ when we plead, come back to God. For God made Christ, who never sinned, to be an offering for our sin, so that we could be made right with God through Christ. God can heal the broken heart. And I get it, he doesn't always heal a friendship. And my relationship with Gary is still broken. And I don't have any way to contact him, as far as I know. Probably still is not interested in talking to me. But I did have one friend, a friend in the church that I hurt, legitimately hurt. I was at a retreat, a men's retreat. I don't know what I was doing. I got it in my head. We were playing some silly game. And I did something that was really thoughtless. He was chasing me. I irritated him for some reason. I don't know why, but he was chasing me, and there was a picnic table in front of me. And I thought, I'm going to crash in the picnic table. But I knew he was right behind me. And so I jumped left, and he crashed into that picnic table. Hurt himself pretty good. And I was thinking, that was so immature, so stupid of me. But I felt shame, and I didn't really, in my shame, I stepped away from him, and he was ticked off with me, so I think he stepped away from me, and we didn't talk that well during the rest of the retreat. And it kind of hampered my worship time during the retreat, to be honest. In fact, not even just the worship time at the retreat, every Sunday morning that I showed up to church, it hampered my worship time. And then I thought about this passage of Jesus' words in Matthew 5. And so finally, getting beyond my shame and embracing God's mercy and forgiveness and power, I went up to him. And I said, Ken, I'm really sorry. It was thoughtless. It was irresponsible. It was immature. It was wrong of me to treat you the way I did at that retreat. It's been a burden on my heart for so long, and I needed to apologize. Can you forgive me? Ken's a great guy. And it's almost like he stood up taller. He had this big smile on his face, and he said, Cal, I'm so glad that you came up. I've been waiting, and I forgive you. And it was at that point that I felt like there was a connection again, a clear connection between God and I. And I think that's what happens in reconciliation. Is that as we sort this out, this starts to become clearer and clearer. Jesus, I believe, is creating a new kind of community with relationships and restoration matters. That when we see reconciliation here on earth, we are getting a taste of this greater spiritual reality that is happening in heaven. That forgiveness isn't for weak people, but it's the only way to win in this life. It's a means of receiving healing for ourselves and for other people. Can you imagine if we were known as people who consistently reconciled with those that we are in broken relationship with? If Christians around the world sought after reconciliation, what kind of testimony that is? If we started sharing our stories of reconciliation with one another, that is winsome. That is appealing. I think more and more people would start to see, I see God in that. I want to be part of that. Tell me more. I think there's something special. In wrapping things up, let me ask a few questions. This morning, do you need some bathroom time? Some time to look in the mirror, to see the imperfections, but don't stop there, but draw closer to the light. Do you need to maybe step away from the altar and patch up a relationship? Or thirdly, do you need to step towards Jesus and get that relationship right? So my last question for all of us, what will your restoration story be?